Welcome back to Film Fight Club. We're here again. The Oscars was last week. We're going to comment on it fashionably late.
Yeah,
and still isn't here.
The Oscars are a very shallow ceremony.
They were, which is why we had to lead with shallow.
So yeah. Shallow that this performance was actually the highlight of the night, according to many.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right. I mean,
the music outshone the films.
Yeah,
if
definitely.
You break a word into four syllables, it better be outstanding.
Well, they brought genuine showmanship and professionalism to the show, which was in short supply. This is Chris Evans. We're joined by Virat Nehru, of course, and a special guest for this episode, film fan Chanel Tarabay.
Hello, hello.
We're holding down the fort while Glenn continues his interminable tour of Europe.
I don't know where he is. He alive?
He keeps sending new pictures of his forehead to us on Facebook.
Yes. You know? Literally his bucket hat, his glasses, and his forehead. That's all we see.
Well, it could be literally anyone. You know, we don't know it's Glenn or not, but considering it's on brand.
I disagree with you. I recognize that forehead anywhere. But I don't think you would do the forehead selfie unless you were truly Glenn. It's like if I was worried that body snatchers had taken Glenn, I would ask them to take a selfie.
Yeah.
And
if you could see the entire face, you know somebody's
something's
like,
wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So in true Film Fight Club fashion, we're going to be covering things fashionably late. Now that everyone's sick of them and ready to move on to the rest of the film lineup for 2019, we're going to be talking about what else? The Oscars. This year, there's been, I feel, less enthusiasm around the Oscars than ever before. And I think people have been getting sick of it for years. But Glenn commented on a Facebook chat we had with him that for the first time ever, he didn't even bother to watch the ceremony. I watched about an hour of it.
I didn't watch it live. I recorded it, in air quotes, and then saw it later because I was like, I can't be bothered. But I had to basically avoid all spoilers. So I did the whole thing. But then eventually, I was just disappointed anyway. So I probably would have been okay if I saw the spoilers.
It was very unremarkable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was coming over to see you, Chris, and I walked in and Chris was like, oh, you're just in time for this award. And I went, oh, the Oscars, that's today.
You know, yeah. I actually had the same thing. Usually I follow the Oscars religiously and I woke up and saw, oh, the Oscars are today.
Yes.
I was like, oh, I guess I may as well watch it.
Kind of like just crept up on you. And also,
yeah, there was so much negative publicity around the Oscars this year from feuds over Green Book and associated
the
controversies.
Kevin Hart debacle.
Oscar host because of
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Cutting the cinematography and editing awards and then facing major backlash and having to reintroduce them. The Oscars feel poisonous now to the extent that nobody wanted to host them.
That's true, but also the non-hosts did a way better job than the actual hosts. Well,
there was really not that much difference.
Yeah, that's true.
But it raises the question of why do the Oscars need a host with a huge repertoire? Like,
the thing is,
bring the attention back to the awards because some of the speeches are where you see the most genuine and interesting moments of the night. I like the humanity that comes out in various shades in seeing the way that people respond.
I'm going to come up with the first hot take of the night, which is I feel the speeches for the technical awards, which are often overlooked and they were the first to be cut on the chopping line, are the more humane
I agree.
And genuine
the best part
because they don't feel like they're rehearsed. And they actually go up there and they fluster.
Exactly.
And they don't know that they're going to be cut off and they don't feel forced. And, you know, they're often the more they feel human.
They come from people who aren't rehearsed in the art of being a celebrity.
Yeah.
Who don't exist in the world of fame and don't expect to ever be on television to hundreds of millions of people. So I agree. They feel way more human. The whole idea from the Academy of cutting cinematography and editing awards was such a disaster. Like, those are two of the most important awards. Like, as a film fan, those are the awards that I actually care about.
Especially
the decision about it
in the year when you had Roma and Cold War in cinematography.
Oh, yeah.
I
think even the average person who doesn't care that much about films knows how important cinematography editing are.
Yeah.
Cinematography especially. Editing is more invisible to people until they start to really gain an appreciation for the craft. Mm-hmm. But everyone loves the craftsmanship of
everybody thinks they're a cameraman.
Film.
Yeah, now you know, especially with Polaroids being vintage.
Oh yeah, yeah. Everyone thinks they can do it, but man, to create anything on the level of anything that was nominated in cinematography,
which actually I think cinematography this year was probably the most interesting category in terms of the nominees this year. I wasn't even that interested in the Best Picture noms or even Best Actor. So the big noms actually were less interesting for me.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting that they nominated Never Look Away. Mm. Caleb Deschanel is a legend. Mm. I had barely heard of Never Look Away before it was nominated for Best Cinematography and I think Best Foreign Language Film as well. It's a new Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck film, apparently.
Even in Best Doco, Free Solo, which won, was in cinemas around the same time.
Yeah.
So I think it was probably a great moment to actually, in Australian cinemas, not I think everywhere else.
I still haven't seen it, but I've heard some people say that it's fairly unremarkable as a documentary. Have you got it?
No, but it was just interesting for me to be like, okay, wow, something
current
won the Oscars actually in cinemas, and you know we don't have to wait for like an eternity or you know other illegal sources to go and watch it.
Yep. No, there were a few interesting nominations of foreign films outside of the obvious juggernaut of Roma this year. Caleb Deschanel getting in for Best Cinematography, as I mentioned before, but also the makeup team behind Border, which I still haven't caught, heard mixed things about it. An Icelandic
but
film
like,
getting nominated.
But even makeup, Vice won for makeup, right?
Yes.
It did, yeah.
Yeah, and that was unremarkable.
Vice was outright bad in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but also like in terms of makeup was not that impressive.
No, I agree.
You know, Christian Bale can transform himself. We know that.
I think it shows that Adam McKay has a lot of friends in Hollywood. Vice went as far as it did. Because Vice, I'll give it that it's interesting.
Yeah.
Like Vice took some chances with the standard biopic or political film formula, which were interesting, but the execution was really bad. It was such a lecture. It was so one-sided.
I would say Melissa McCarthy in Can You Forgive Me had better makeup than anyone in Vice.
Can I just say that
Can You Forgive Me was so overlooked.
I think that she should have won Best Actress.
Yes.
I agree.
I think Olivia Colman was one of the best picks of the night.
Mostly because of her speech.
To be fair, though, in my opinion, Olivia Colman was a supporting actress.
Yeah,
I don't think she was lead.
I think there was a lot of category fraud going on this year. We had Mahershala Ali, who is basically the co-lead of Green Book, winning Best Supporting Actor. Mm-hmm. This is definitely...
That should have gone to Richard E. Grant.
100%. Yes, Richard E. Grant gave a better performance.
Yeah.
Definitely way better than Mahershala Ali. Way more lived in and genuine, not just a caricature. And Olivia Colman, I think, was less the main act. I think the lead was Emma Stone.
Yeah.
And
I would say all three of them were
the actress nominee
equally
kind of essential.
I would say all three of them were best supporting. They were supporting each other in equal ways.
But if anyone has to be marked as the lead, I think it was Emma Stone.
Yeah. She has the most screen time.
I think it's bizarre that...
And it centers around her journey, really, more than anything.
Yeah, it does. And I also think that Rachel Weisz had a bigger role than Olivia Colman.
I did feel that if they were going to give it to Glenn Close, I think this was the best opportunity. This opportunity too, because
I know what she's doing now.
Eventually, did see The Wife, and I did kind of enjoy her performance.
Did you enjoy the film?
The film, not so much. But I guess the thing is, especially this year, if we're going by, let's say, the male side of things, both films I did enjoy, Bohemian Rhapsody and The Green Book, but the performances were the ones that stood out, and that's why they won. So if we're going by that logic, I think Glenn Close deserved it in a mediocre film. Mm-hmm. She gave an extraordinary performance.
She sounds like she's doing the baitiest role ever next. Do you know what she's doing? It's a Sunset Boulevard musical.
Oh my God. Well, they have to give it to her then. I think she's picked the right thing, right? If it's about the movies, it's more likely to win something.
Yeah. Exactly.
And she's one of those, you know, kind of personalities that are considered quote unquote owed.
I know.
You know, the Academy has this thing of giving people who are owed their awards.
You know, skipping over people because they have no taste or judgment until it's way too late.
Yeah.
Scorsese wins for The Departed, Leo wins for The Revenant, Spike Lee wins for Black Klansman.
Instead of Do the Right Thing, which was a masterpiece.
People do great work and then end up winning for something very average by their standards.
Yes, yes.
All the time.
Give it a few more years and Melissa McCarthy might win her Best Actress Award
for
something not as good.
But the thing is, that actually kind of took me by surprise and I think may have taken a lot of Academy voters by surprise because they still probably see her as a comedic actress.
Yeah, I didn't think she was ever going to win because of that.
It's really sad about how the Academy still
stigmatizes?
Yeah, or they have their own categories about this can't win.
Yep.
Or this is too controversial to win. So they always pick the safe bet, which I feel is what happened with The Green Book. But we'll talk about that later.
Another thing that we'll talk about more later, in this case meaning next week, is the shameful snubbing of If Beale Street Could Talk.
Yes.
Oh my God, yes.
Ridiculous.
How was that not nominated?
I have no idea why.
Many things.
Yeah, many things.
Production design.
I think the production design in that was way, way better than Black Panther, which won. Somehow Black Panther took out production and costume design.
Yeah.
And I don't think Black Panther...
If there is one award that the favorite deserves, loved. It was costumes.
Design and production design. Production design would be a good award for the favorite.
I hated fish eyes, but it's still, the production was great.
Production design was great, but cinematography, I think, relied too much on affectations. But if Beale Street Could Talk had such a beautiful, homely, lived-in vision of the 1970s, it wasn't just the cliche period reproduction of something like American Hustle. It was like really extraordinary work. And the outfits in that movie
are fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Right? The costume, that surely should have been up for costume design.
People have been saying that Baldwin cannot be made for screen, and Barry Jenkins
found
has proved them wrong.
The thing about the Black Panther design is I see how you can push it to the Academy. Like, look at how we're fusing sci-fi and African influences, but it's not actually that distinctive. I remember watching Black Panther and thinking the sense of wonder about this world is lacking when the film is straining so much to try and create that feeling.
It is, but also at the same time, I felt what Beale Street could do in its budget was more impressive in the kind of money that was thrown around for Black Panther. I think
Yeah, that's right. Definitely, I think the crafts.
The ambition for Beale Street, I think, was way higher because you have to actually be thinking outside of the box. Whereas, in Black Panther, you can construct a set. You can construct, and you have that money to kind of really go intricate and,
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about some of the good picks.
Yeah.
Best visual effects. First Man. I think that was one of the few things that I really liked about the film.
Still,
I think it was
score. First Man missed out on that, and I was just so surprised.
Score? Was it nominated?
No, it should have been. I think the sound mixing, sound design, or score.
Actually, all of those were good, but I think, again, what should have won for best score was If Beale Street Could Talk, which was fortunately nominated.
Yeah.
But how is If Beale Street Could Talk not nominated also for cinematography? That was stunning work.
As it came out on Valentine's Day in Australia. Let's marvel at the beauty of that kind of
anti-corporate
construct. Yep. And something like Beale Street Could Talk is coming out in that kind of week.
But it is a really beautiful
and
film about love.
And it's such a, because it's not over the top and like overloading your senses.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel it was too subtle for the voters, I think.
Yeah,
I think so.
Because it just requires that kind of felt appreciation, which, compared with, let's say, Roma, I think people go for it because of Cuarón and not necessarily because...
I think that's correct.
It's the name, yep.
The Mexican triad.
Yeah, I think also, as... Chris, you've actually commented on this to me before, but If Beale Street Could Talk is very much not Hollywood style, it's more European style.
Yeah,
and the Academy will 100%, vote for Hollywood style over European style every single time.
The big surprise this year is that a very European style film, Cold War, got in. But then again, when I saw Cold War... I said, this could win Best Foreign Language Film. I didn't see Roma juggernaut coming at that point.
I was heartbroken. In June. I was really gunning for Cold War. I mean, it's so beautifully shot.
It is interesting how much they went for Cold War, that it was nominated for cinematography and Best Director. But I think it's a very compact, straightforward and linear in terms
Cuarón
of the way the
kind
story's
of like
told.
Stole Pavlikovsky's narrative because they both went
black
for
and
the,
white.
The same personal story because, it's Pavlikovsky's family and kind of his parents' is owed to his parents. And Cuarón was like, hang on. I've also done this, by the way. And then, you had to pick one, and Roma kind of picked the post.
Cuarón also made a very non-Hollywood style film in terms of how subtle it is and in terms of how slow the pacing is and the focus on big, spacious aesthetics. It's very European style filmmaking
but Cuarón has friends
in Hollywood.
Yeah, I still don't think it's not about
Harry Potter movies.
Yeah.
I don't think it's about the quality of the film. It's about, what kind of clout you have, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But the other thing that Cuarón didn't have going for him, the Academy hates Netflix.
But he still ended up with 3, which is
true, but he was never going to win Best Picture, their biggest one.
Speaking as we were of Best Foreign Language Film, Roma steamrolled everything there. I think Roma is not a disgraceful pick, personally. I think it's a really good film.
Yeah.
But there were some great ones up there. Shoplifters, I was arguing with Chanel when we were watching the Oscars that I said Shoplifters might be the best, and Chanel thought it was Roma. What do you think, Virat?
I really think foreign language was the most competitive category of this year's Oscars.
Agreed.
It was the most interesting as well because probably the only category which I saw all the films in.
Was your favorite Cold War?
I was, Cold War was by far my favorite. So I would have thought Cold War winning foreign language, Roma winning best picture.
Yes.
And, it would have been a nice compromise and the life could have been simpler.
The minute I saw that Roma won foreign picture, I was like, okay, it's not winning best film.
It's not winning,
yeah.
So it potentially could have won both.
It was never going to happen.
Would have been great.
Though.
Yeah.
But yeah, probably the way that Academy voters think is, okay, Rome is on this. I'm going to tick that for foreign language, and it's easily going to win that, so it doesn't need to win Best Picture.
Yeah. But is it that, or is it because they think Roma is still as a foreign language film?
Yeah.
Rather than an American film, which is a very interesting thought through line that we can sort of explore eventually. Like, what do the Academy voters now think as an American film now?
As an aside, how insulting is it to think that Roma is the best foreign language film of the year and Green Book is better than all the foreign language films made in 2018?
It's not true, guys.
Jesus. Yeah.
Even the worst foreign language film in that category is way better than Green Book.
I don't know. I didn't see the Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, and it wouldn't surprise me based on his history if it's not better than Green Book.
It is. It is, guys.
Yeah, but please, guys, go and try and see Shoplifters if you can.
Shoplifters is such a beautiful film.
Please go and try and see Cold War.
Cold
War is apparently not getting a Blu-ray release in the US.
That's egregious. It's absurd that everything's going away from Blu-ray and going towards streaming. Speaking of which, Steven Spielberg has been campaigning in the last week to stop Netflix films from being nominated for Best Picture. And Chanel theorized earlier that
much earlier in the year, I said, look, I can't see Roma winning Best Film because it's Netflix. There is this, perception in, kind of saving the purity of film and, we've got to protect our industry and we've got to push back against Netflix. And I think because of that, Roma might have borne a little bit of the brunt of that.
Mm. It's interesting. Paul Schrader, of all his hot takes on
Facebook, the same thing. Paul Schrader had the best response.
Good and very kind of considered response, which is surprising given Paul Schrader.
Paul Schrader,
because he doesn't have considered response on
social
media.
Yeah, he's often like, he's a hothead, but he said, I have no bias against Netflix. I think Ted Sarandos is as smart about
By the way,
film.
Paul Schrader did First Reformed, which should have been nominated for everything, and Ethan Hawke probably should have won Best Actor.
First Reformed was
good. Just saying.
Ethan Hawke should have been nominated. It's shameful that he wasn't. He wasn't nominated, was he?
He should have won Best Actor anyway. Even if he wasn't nominated,
it's shameful.
People should go back, nominate him, and make him win Best
and
Actor.
And that should easily have won Best Original Screenplay over Green Book.
For God's sake, guys.
And Paul Schrader...
He has hot takes on social media, but he does make great films.
Has Paul Schrader won a...
what was his hot take, guys? You never said that.
Oh, sorry. Let's go back to the hot take again.
Actually,
the considered take.
He said, look, Ted Sarandos is as smart as any film executive out there, so I've got no... I'm fine with working with him. I've got nothing against Netflix, but consider this. They bury their films. He said First Reformed was bought for really cheap by A24 and they kept it in the conversation because it was a theatrical film being released in theaters.
Yeah.
He said if Netflix had...
It was passed down by Netflix and Amazon, by the way.
They passed on it. So, and he said if First Reformed had been picked up on by Netflix, it wouldn't have the level of public acceptance that it has. It wouldn't be part of any conversation and it probably would have just been relegated to the realm of film esoterica. Which I think is correct. The only films that from Netflix that really make a splash are the ones they give their big push to, like Bird Box and Roma.
Annihilation as well.
Annihilation was released in cinemas in America, which has a level of...
Imagine First Reform prestige. Going up against The Kissing Booth.
Yeah.
What would you watch on a weeknight?
Netflix buy up a lot of...
Kissing Booth, surely.
Netflix buy up a lot of films from festivals, and then they just release them on the service with zero fanfare, and... It has the same level of prestige as a direct-to-video movie, essentially, because it's just a name that, to the average person, it's just one more name that they see on Netflix.
Yeah.
Like, even a movie with big actors in it, like, what was the Noah Baumbach movie? The Meyerowitz Stories?
Oh, Meyerowitz Stories,
That was a movie that had Ben Stiller, Adam Sandler,
Dustin Hoffman.
And that
was a great film.
It was really good. It was like the best Woody Allen film of the past decade. And
not made by Woody Allen.
Yeah. And it's been completely forgotten. No one noticed
it.
No one outside
of this kind of
community knew that it existed.
Well, there's another Netflix movie that I think the Oscars kind of missed out on a little bit. Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Ballad of Buster Scruggs was really good.
That got nominated for original song, I think.
Yeah. And adapted screenplay.
There could have been a few more awards, I think.
Definitely. Ballad of Buster Scruggs,
editing,
I think.
Editing was excellent.
I thought Ballad of Buster Scruggs was beautiful. I think Best Picture easily.
Yep.
It's on par with most,
at least better than Green Book. Still better than Green Book, actually.
It's way better than Green Book.
But also, like, coming back to Roma and, like, why it probably worked for Netflix, I think the curiosity element of, like, Cuaron, who's done Gravity and Harry Potter, now has a film on Netflix. I better check it out.
That's right.
So I think it's basically like the director prestige.
But they decided that this was the big Oscar play for the year, and they pushed it hard. Yeah. And they released it to theaters internationally, not just in America. And Netflix never does that.
It's going to be interesting how when The Irishman comes out.
Oh, yeah, because you know, what happens Netflix want to win Best Picture next year. But meanwhile...
So that's basically only
Spielberg
one
will
film...
be pushing hard against it.
One film can have a chance at that, right? And Netflix would go... gangbusters to
That's
promote
right.
that just one film
but
every year.
All
the other ones probably will never have that.
Get the position that First Reformed did, where people know it in America and people were talking about it as a potential Academy Award nominee just because A24 kept pushing it in cinemas over. They gave it a 14-month campaign.
We were really lucky to see it at MIFF and probably one of the biggest screens.
Yeah.
In an extreme screen.
Back
extreme
to Paul Schrader's solution that he proposed, he said that there's nothing particularly... important about people just sitting in the dark in the theater. That was only something that developed because of the economic realities, that it was the most feasible way to show films, and things change, which is a very smart thing for an old man like Paul Schrader to say when everyone's clinging to the nostalgia of 35 millimeter film projected in the darkness. But his idea was that there should be two tiers.
Yep.
So first cinema / something like Mubi or the Criterion Channel. And then after something's been exclusive to a prestige service like that,
then
months
it gets
down
released.
The line, then it goes to Netflix, Hulu, etc. I think brilliant idea, right? And it would also get more people to subscribe to these smaller streaming services like Mubi that are trying to keep
Mubi
scene alive.
Mubi's great.
Mubi's amazing, right?
And Criterion Channel,
it's so good.
Criterion Channel is recently coming back from April 8th with their online service. So
that's right.
You know, I've already subscribed.
Yeah. Guys, totally forget Netflix and Stan. Get on Mubi. Every day a movie is released.
A movie on Mubi.
If you guys don't know about it, Mubi gives you a new movie every day, which is available for 30 days, and it's a really widely curated spectrum of interesting films.
Yeah,
sometimes
recently,
they're not so good, but they're always interesting, and sometimes they're amazing.
Look, recently they've been putting up films direct from the Berlinale.
Yeah, that's right.
So you can see things screening at Berlin Film Fest on your TV screen.
Pretty much.
It's fantastic.
And like they actually have a very wide range of films, not just European cinema, which is fantastic. They cover a lot of Asian cinema as well.
That's right. Even something like Lost in Translation can pop up on Mubi. Yeah. It's a really interesting service. Anyway, moving on.
That is a great solution from Paul Schrader. But you know what another solution is if you want to push back against Netflix? Please start funding good films. I mean, there's a reason why Roma had to go to Netflix and why Buster Scruggs had to go to Netflix. And why all these kinds of movies... Annihilation was one of those ones that was picked up by a production company.
Yeah, Paramount dumped it.
And then
they
dumped
it.
It
wasn't worth releasing in cinemas.
Yeah, and then even though I'm not as big a fan of Annihilation as I think... You know,
it's something that deserves
some people
to exist.
Make it. Yeah, exactly.
Something off the beaten path.
So
I mean, you're right. Because with Annihilation, we went to basically great lengths to even it's on Netflix. We ended up going to see it in 4K.
We had to go to someone's house,
like a private theater.
So just imagine, like you just put stuff out there, and there are people who'll go to great lengths to see it in the way that it should be seen.
Exactly. Spielberg, I think, is so wrong-headed because he's a guy who can get any film he wants made at this point. Yeah. Not everyone is as privileged as he is
he
in that department.
Privilege.
And if Netflix are putting up the money for risky and unusual projects, and no one else is. You know, it seems wrong to then say, well, that's just a TV movie that should win an Emmy. Because I think some of the best talent who are definitely thinking cinematically are having to go to Netflix to get their visions realized.
Yeah,
even
Scorsese has to, for a time, you know, the Wachowskis had to go to Netflix
because people
lost faith in the Wachowskis. Granted, they didn't have a good run of, you know, recent films, but it's the Wachowskis.
Yeah, exactly.
But even like we're talking about viewing experiences, and it's kind of like blown out of proportion because people have like home theaters like in their homes now.
It's the new nature of what
and you have
film
a big
is,
enough screen
it?
And you have a projector, you can pretty much recreate the cinematic experience at the comfort of your home, and that's fine. Like, you know, it
raises the question though, what is cinema? Like what
should
qualify you for the Oscars? What makes Netflix movies different from TV movies?
They're movies.
I agree. I think you can
platform.
Just feel that it's a cinematic thinking.
But when the
lines are blurred that much, Spielberg has a point to the extent of like, how do you differentiate it from
There is a difference about what this makes is the Netflix idea about like digital film versus like actual 35mm film or 18mm or 16mm film.
Or even something made to be seen at cinemas. Like what is it that makes Netflix different?
Like Roma was a Netflix film. The first time I saw it in the cinemas.
Yeah.
Before I saw it like on a laptop.
I mean, it is. Yeah. It's one of those things where it's just like you know it because you see it and you can feel. Like people who work usually in cinema medium are working with Netflix instead of working on traditional theatrical routes. But otherwise, what difference is there?
I think there's a level of, you know, what the underlying intention is there. Like, is it intended to be just pure entertainment, right? Or is it intended to be not just pure entertainment, but also art? Is it intended to make a cultural contribution? You know, like
I agree with that.
That can also form part of what the distinction is.
I agree with that, but there's also maybe a level of snobbishness in going down that line, because I'm sure there's people in the Emmys who are nominated for like best TV movie who would come forward and say, hang on,
totally.
We are making a contribution.
You're exactly right. Like, and that's not entirely what I mean.
Mm.
But there is like a scope for understanding movies that are intended to be cinema versus something that's intended to be pure entertainment. Like, like something that immediately comes to mind is like reality TV, right?
Yeah,
I understand that that's not cinema, but we can clearly see that that's not intended as art. It's not intended
as,
you know, as
a cultural statement. Really.
Yeah, it's just intended as pure entertainment, right?
But,
But even then, I think what Shredder is trying to make a point, and the other thing that kind of gets lost in it, is how do we segmentize from, let's say, a Bird Box and the Kissing Booth to prestige cinema, which is Roma or First Reformed.
Why is one a TV movie and one a real film?
But they're on the same platform, right? And most people are going to pick the Kissing Booth. It's just how life is. And most people are not going to watch First Reformed, even if you do give it a big push. It's just that it exists and we're happy about that. But, you know, are we trying to make a commercial argument about it, that it needs certain kind of numbers or people should be watching it, or are we just saying we're glad that it exists and there is a artistic kind of pushing the boundaries that requires to happen for it to be like completely art or commerce based?
And to go back to the TV movie argument before, there was a lot of praise for The Tale last year, which is a TV film, and it was shown at Sydney Film Festival and MIFF as a full length film.
Actually,
it had Laura Dern in it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No. Favorite Oscar moment.
What is the difference between The Tale and Roma? Essentially, like, why is one cinema? They were both given limited theatrical runs.
Quick segue. Actually, the best Oscar moment of 2019 was Laura Dern explaining to us.
You know, I missed it.
A museum that doesn't exist yet. And I was like, she just made interesting.
Did she become the governor? I know that she was trying to run. I've been out of it. I know she was trying to become the Academy governor. Did she win?
I'm not
did she
sure.
Succeed? She's not. She
no, no. Inarritu won. No. He's the Khan. He's the Khan jury president. I don't know what happened.
Okay.
But no. Laura Dern. Yes. So she can do anything. She can just make museums fun, guys. Yeah. That's the thing.
Yay, Laura Dern.
Or like non-existent museums. Like this museum, not even real yet.
But it's
she
coming.
Made it sound so fun.
What's it? What's the museum?
It's the Oscars museum.
And she made that sound fun.
Yeah.
So, but like,
she's
I just
a talented actress indeed.
But like, I just want to further my point so that I'm not being misconstrued, because like, no disrespect to like those movies at the Emmys, etc. Like, I'm not saying that these movies aren't trying to make a contribution. Mm. But
Twin Peaks was some of the best.
Yeah, but like,
whatever you call it,
exactly.
Cinema, film,
but like, to some extent, you know, Spielberg's kind of wrong in having, you know, this split between what's an Emmy-worthy movie and what's an Oscar-worthy movie. Like, I don't think we should be thinking about things being different in terms of the medium that they're on, as opposed to more about, you know, the kind of intentionality behind
it. I mean, Netflix push one.
But just on a literal level, it gets blurry.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Netflix are trying to push their prestige cinema, their one prestige film that they think is Oscar bait, which is what the Academy does as well. From its like nomination, you know, runtime, they pick out their Oscar bait narratives and films, which may not be the best films of the year, but which they think are Oscar worthy. So technically, you know, even Hollywood is doing the same thing which Netflix is doing.
Exactly.
I mean, Netflix is not going to put up The Kissing Booth for Oscars, right? That's not going to happen, guys. Okay, Actually, it would be interesting though if it does. I'm just thinking about it now. Actually, just like exploded my mind internally. Just be like, oh my god, oh, this year's Oscar goes to the kissing booth.
That's that's what'll happen if Disney get their way and we have best popular feature.
I think that's what Spielberg thinks might happen, and that's the fear, right? And I think this kind of very slippery slope argument.
He should talk to his friend Scorsese.
Yeah.
About
are they friends anymore?
Maybe. But he should
are old
ask him
old
about
people like after a certain age just like in the same circle? Is that how it happens?
Maybe, yeah. Because
all their other friends are dying. So you're my friend now.
Yeah,
yeah. They should. He should.
Plot
ask
line
him
of
about
youth.
His
the Michael Caine movie
on Netflix and whether it's real cinema, because Scorsese is one of those old school traditionalists, and he has had to go to Netflix in order to realize his artistic vision when no one else will fund it.
Yep.
The real answer to is if you want to stop. I think Scorsese's raging against the wind. Inevitably, I think Netflix is going to be more
you
and
mean Spielberg.
More, oh, sorry. Yeah, that's right. I think Spielberg's raging against the wind. Inevitably, more and more Netflix and related services are going to be a part of the Oscar conversation and the conversation of serious cinema. And the reason for that is that the film world's become too corporatized and it's not funding interesting films. And if the interesting cinematic minds are making films for the streaming services, then you know we'll simply have to change the definition and accept that's what cinema is because there's a shortage of interesting, challenging artistic work elsewhere.
And even
if the Academy wants to be about celebrating that, where else are they going to go?
Yep,
that's true. But even Netflix and Amazon are corporatized, right? They're not essentially artistic streaming services.
But they're looking, but they're funding things for prestige, which the a lot of
we'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah, we will see. It could be a bubble that's about to pop. But
which is why Criterion and MUBI are an interesting sort of side offshoot which need to exist as well.
I think what's happened on a cultural level in Hollywood is that executives used to come from the film world, and so they would fund films for the sake of pride, for the sake of we want to have these jewels in our crown that attract the talent to work with our studio because, hey, we worked with Stanley Kubrick, and look at this film that we made. You know, it wasn't profitable, but it adds to the long-term profitability from the company. And also, I think coming from the film world, there is just a level of pride about we're here because, you know, to make money, but not just for that. We also want to make something that lasts.
Yeah.
Whereas I think when executives come entirely from the corporate world and studios are just one small cog in larger and larger and larger corporate machines, people don't care about that so much. The profit motive is the only thing because the executives don't have that personal relationship with the world of cinema.
Yeah.
And so that's why prestige filmmaking's falling away. You know that Fox Searchlight is, which is the prestige arm of 20th Century Fox, is getting the axe and being turned into a label that makes films for the streaming services now that Disney's buying Fox. And that's just the way of the future.
It's true.
Netflix still care about that prestige.
They do. And
for the time
being,
at least.
But there are at least smaller production houses, like let's say A24. If you look at all they've bought, which is all up on Canopy.
And they're funding their own films now.
Yeah, you can see all of A24 titles on Canopy, which is fantastic as well. But, you know, and
Canopy and MUBI.
Which is amazing. So, you know, it's like smaller boutique houses may have to say about what they feel is interesting content versus just corporate houses because the way Marvel and the way, you know, production
Marvel
is going.
Own our souls.
Oh my God, it's just sad. Even though Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was fun.
That was good, but it wasn't a Marvel cinematic universe.
It begrudges me to kind of like just, you know, my insides burn.
Yeah,
to some
I felt the same way. It was such a good film, but like it feels wrong to give praise to another superhero
film. It's just like...
Because I am a snob, okay?
It's just like my internal intestines just had to like wriggle a little bit. It's like, oh my God, how do I say this without feeling like, oh my God, I'm misplacing Marvel.
Yeah.
It's not real Marvel, guys.
Anyway.
Wait, just while we're making shout-outs, shout-out to Film Club in Surrey Hills, one of Sydney's last remaining DVD and video rent stores. I think it's no more videos, actually. It might be just DVD and Blu-rays.
It's just
DVD and Blu-rays.
Yeah.
But like,
if they were renting out VHS,
but, like,
that would be truly
heroic. That would be amazing. But guys, like, they stock cinema from all around the world. It's not just your cinema blockbusters. Like, we raid the Middle Eastern section.
Yeah,
we
They import Criterion, Masters of Cinema, releases like that.
Director Suite.
They're about putting out interesting cinema. Yeah, shout outs to people like that who are fighting the good fight to keep
good film art
flowing around Sydney.
Are the things region locked?
Some of them are, but that's why you've got to do what I did and get a region free player.
Yeah. Yay. So, but yeah, guys, if you are in around Sydney, visit Film Club in Darlinghurst for all your film needs. Are you looking for the next film to watch by a director you've never heard of before? Please go to Film Club.
Or a director you have heard of before, because they've got a director's section where films are arranged by the director's name. Anyway, this...
Or you could be the next director. The big director.
Maybe.
Or a director. Something.
You should go in and annoy the staff at Film Club with like burnt DVDs.
Especially
of all the
Ian Barr.
Especially
Give
Ian
it to
Barr.
Ian Barr.
Yep. Yeah. Anyway.
Love you, Ian.
You could be barred.
This tangent is going to an end. Back to the Oscars. I think Roma was far and away the best film nominated for Best Picture. I think a lot of the awards that won were deserved. I think you can make the argument for Cold War for cinematography, but I think Roma is an equally good pick.
Yeah.
Same goes for... Best director,
I think, hands down, he was.
Because everyone else was just too toxic, right? I mean, you can't, especially best director.
All lackluster.
Polakowski.
Yeah, once again. Actually, yeah.
Yeah.
So, in a way, I think it's the win like European cinema that it was at least considered as a nominee.
I think so. I'm happy that Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse won for animated picture. I think that it would have been so safe to give it to Incredibles 2, but who remembers that movie? Like, who cares about The Incredibles 2? I was a huge fan of The Incredibles 2.
I think just because of the epilepsy warning that he had to come with for the cinema that I went to.
And even the short animated feature, which was Bao, which was very cute.
Yeah. It was adorable. Yeah,
very adorable. And
they won the best animated short film.
Yeah.
So what was I going to say? Yeah, Roma was good. A Star is Born, I think, would have been too much following the trajectory of movies about Hollywood and the fame industry.
But also, The Star is Born is just a good film. That's it.
Yeah,
right?
I feel like it shouldn't have gotten shut out entirely the way that it did. Like, I think it could have...
Well, the best thing about the movie was Shallow, and it did win. So I guess it's
that's
not
true.
Bad.
I mean,
I think Bradley Cooper kind of... ruin it for himself by just over publicizing to the extent that how much it is his pet project and how he's, you know, trying to bring attention to interpersonal relationships, which I didn't even understand what he meant by that. I'm like, every movie is about interpersonal relationships. Come on, Bradley, just pick up your game a bit.
So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the huge Oscar movies that we never spoke about on the show last year. A little bit of a catch-up. So movies you guys have seen and can tell us your opinions on if you disagree. Bohemian Rhapsody and the big elephant in the room that we've been avoiding mentioning, Green Book. Firstly, what did we think of Bohemian Rhapsody? I avoided that movie last year because I thought, I do not care. This looks like a standard issue biopic. But watching the Oscars, I thought, geez, I guess I finally have to just buckle down and get this shit out of the way. Because
I know. So,
in other words, I'm saying I was biased. But it did not win over me.
No, it's not a good film. But in a way, I get it. It's not meant to be a good film.
It was nominated for Best Picture.
I know. Just keeping aside the Oscar lens for a second, a lot of my friends who went to watch it, a lot of friends from LGBT communities, they were just happy to see a film based on Freddie's life. They just went in to sing songs. They didn't even go to see the sing-along version. They're just happy to be like, I just went there to have a good time.
Yeah, me and Chanel were talking to Olivia
were not actually
saying exactly that.
Yeah, they
didn't care about the representation because they're like, we know it's not going to like do justice to that. So they actually had kind of made peace with that.
I'd heard a lot of anti-hype that this movie completely glossed over that Freddie was gay. And so I was surprised to find that that is actually a major focus of the film. I think
Can we just point out that he was bi? Just for the record.
Well, in the film, it's presented as like he presents himself as being bi, but really he's gay. Which is
I guess there is a shroud over that, but
probably close to the truth if we look at how Freddie lived his life. Yeah.
The thing is, Freddie Mercury's interviews, which are already available publicly on YouTube and whatever, are way more interesting insight to his life and his personality than anything in the movie. So you only got to see the movie basically to enjoy the Live Aid performance, which has been recreated, and that's the best part of the entire 20-minute Live Aid performance.
And it's fun, basically, it's stirring. Like, it's hard not to be moved by a huge stadium rocking out to We Are the Champions.
This could have been like a doco recreation for 20 minutes and I would have enjoyed it. I don't know why.
I'd like to see some like cine essay about Queen that then shows you the Live Aid performance in the style of the McEnroe Realm of Perfection documentary.
Oh my god.
Like the Queen version of that. Yeah. Like Queen in the Live Aid in the Realm of Perfection.
Okay, talking about that, I think Realm of Perfection is playing at Golden Age.
It's a good film. Go catch it, people.
If you love tennis, and you know I love tennis.
Even if you just love documentaries.
It's a really interesting thing. Back to Bohemian Rhapsody. The thing is, it glosses over anything that's potentially interesting. I've want to have more of an insight into the artistic process of how songs are written and how the dynamic between the group works. And I mean, the movie just kind of touches on that, but it really focuses on just, and they were really successful and they steamrolled everything. And I mean, it glosses over huge periods of really fascinating stuff happening. We go from like Freddie Mercury joins Smile and renames them Queen to they're touring the US in like 5 minutes. Yeah. A real biopic would talk about grappling with the fame and creating the image, as opposed to this basically presents it as Freddie Mercury walks in as a genius with a full-formed idea and overnight it's a worldwide sensation. Yeah. And obviously that's not how things really work.
Let's look at what it won, right? It won Best Editing. Then it won all the sound awards.
Mm-hmm. It shouldn't have won all the sound awards. That was silly.
Should have gone to First Man, but that's different.
Yes, First Man had an incredible sound and I was not a fan of that film.
And it won Best Actor.
That was ridiculous. Rami Malek was not that good in this film.
No, he wasn't. And part of it is, look...
Part of it is that they used the real performances of Freddie Mercury's voice, and people were probably thinking, wow, Rami Malek can really sing.
Yeah, but also the part of the thing is, I can just imagine a lot of like middle-aged women actually using that voice, which is fantastic.
I'm not cutting that.
It's insane. Talking about cutting, let's get back to editing.
Yeah. Good segue.
This film is, I wouldn't say badly edited, because there were a lot of memes going around on Twitter about how badly edited this film
is. No, it's not. But it's
But it's like, about the choices in editing, and I think it's badly edited in the sense because
the
it doesn't have a
director.
The montages
with like, low, 70s fonts with 70s video,
I mean,
video,
it's
video
difficult
graphics.
To edit a movie if you don't have a director
really
who's calling the shots, right? Mm.
That's true,
I mean, let's
yeah.
acknowledge that.
Bryan Singer was fired. Dexter Fletcher, director of Rocket Man, was checking the boxes well enough on Rocket Man to get pulled
but,
in
but
to
also,
check the boxes,
I mean,
on this all the way to post-production.
If you're
but
an
he
edit-
wasn't credited. He's an executive producer.
Yeah, when the title card came up for Best Picture, there was no credits
director
for director.
Yep.
And it was pretty surprising. Anyway, we all know about that. But the thing is, as an editor, let's get back to editing, it's very difficult to pick which shot to go with if you don't have somebody with an overarching vision directing
vision
you about,
part.
Like, you know, which shot should you pick? So instead, here, you have all the 5 shots from all the angles in like 10 seconds instead of the one shot which has a consistency
I saw a lot of people crapping on Green Book for having bad use of the camera, but I think it was leaps and bounds ahead of Bohemian Rhapsody.
That's
which
true.
Is by far the worst, the most anonymous in its style of all the films that were up for Best Picture, and also the ugliest. This film has this weirdly desaturated look, like they're trying to recreate the 70s, but it ends up looking really, really harshly digital
Look at go and watch Driving Miss Daisy again and look at match the tone, the color palette of Driving Miss Daisy and Green Book.
Quite similar.
And it's exactly the same.
So on the note, Bohemian Rhapsody, boring, stupid. Yeah, actually, before we wrap on Bohemian Rhapsody, I said to Chanel before we came in that when we talk about Freddie Mercury's private life, like two things I think of are cocaine addict and his struggle with AIDS. And both of those things get totally glossed over. This movie shows like a wild party with Freddie Mercury where he's just shown drinking. And I think, really?
But that's the thing, right? I mean,
and then
Hollywood, for like mainstream Hollywood, I mean, if anything is even remotely controversial,
it's
by
so
controversial,
sanitized.
I don't mean...
It's designed not to offend Queen
and
their fan base.
You want edgy? What?
But
yeah. How could you?
But like, you know, it's not even about sexuality and accepting your sexuality. It's mostly about, here's the version of Freddie Mercury we can accept.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly it.
You know, it's not about, here's how Freddie Mercury was.
No.
Because nobody
and
can accept that.
As much as I feel like death from AIDS is often used as a way to extract cheap emotion just by depicting the physical reality of it.
Yeah.
I really, in a lot of Oscar Beatty type films, like BPM last year, or Philadelphia.
I mean,
I
watch
think
Paris is Burning if you want to like talk about, you know,
interesting
AIDS and how, especially in that time. But anyway.
I think you can't avoid that in a biopic about Freddie Mercury. And that's such an interesting part of his story. For somebody who was on top of the world to die of AIDS, the struggle and the fact that he was closeted, that's really just glossed over in this film.
I think part of that is, we feel like we're in 2019 and sexuality discussions just feel like, oh, we're in 2019, we're over it. But are we though? Like when
Which
the representation
is... Okay,
is
perfect segue to talking about our Best Picture winner, Green Book.
I read a very, very pointed article, an interesting article by Wesley Morris, who's the culture critic for New York Times, back in January about, you know, this kind of very a placid and comfortable relationship that the Academy seems to have with its racial past, trying to reconcile stories and white love narratives where it's all hunky-dory between racial tensions and two cultures try to come together and reconcile their differences. Mm. Those are the narratives that actually loves. And he wrote this back in Jan, and I was like, oh my God, are you like a future teller or something? Because
right.
You kind of knew.
He nailed it. Well, I saw a few people back when it looked like Green Book was stumbling in terms of its Oscar narrative come out and say, book it, it's going to win Best Picture. And I thought, no, surely not. And then it won.
And
Spike Lee turned his back and tried to leave in uproar.
The most interesting thing that happened at the Oscars.
The two most interesting, one is Olivia Colman's winning
Olivia
speech.
Olivia Colman's speech was great.
Which is fantastic. And Spike Lee going up on stage and saying the M...
Do the right thing.
F word.
Oh, yeah.
while, like, literally piggybacking Samuel L. Jackson. That is, like, a moment for the ages.
It was fantastic. Yeah.
Nice role reversal that Spike Lee got to say the MF rather than Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah. That's great. It was great that he managed to get that in over the live senses.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You're not supposed to say that.
Go Spike.
The Oscars. Yeah, go Spike. Green Book, look, I only saw it yesterday. So I had heard all of this negativity surrounding it for a really long time. And I have to say, some of it's warranted, but I think a lot of things have been blown out of proportion. I think Green Book is so inoffensive that I guess that's why people find it offensive, that it's like it's not the time for this film in 2019.
Yeah, the thing is, the film is trying to represent a narrative which didn't exist, especially everything around the film is such an issue, right? Where Dr. Shirley's family doesn't agree with how the film portrays, you know, anything in the narrative. And the producers and the director and the kind of team behind the Green Book are themselves kind of bigoted.
Yeah.
So, you know, for them to kind of make this kind of movie and then go up on stage and say and then claim that it's a story out of love and compassion and bringing people together kind of felt just
unjustified.
False.
Yeah. One of the best scenes in the film is where Dr. Shirley gets up and puts Tony Lip in his place for saying, you know, I'm more black than you because I'm in contact with the poor and street people and things like that. And Mahershala Ali, as Dr. Shirley, gets up and says, in his pretty much his Oscar clip, no, look at the actual prejudice I have to sit in and the way that I seem to sit between worlds. But a good point I saw raised about that was that the film manipulates you and makes such a caricature out of Doc Shirley that you can almost agree with the extremely bigoted thing that Tony Lip said, that I'm more black than you.
Yeah, and kind of like, isn't that what people's perception is about what race relations have come to, right?
Yeah.
That we're living in a post-identity politics world where people are struggling to come to the acceptance of the fact that what has happened throughout race relations has had an impact and come to terms with owning the kind of oppression that they've subjected on other people. Mm. And it's difficult for people in majority positions to really accept that.
Yeah, and I think generally people have always and still do have a problem with people who aren't black or people of color making a film about people who are black or people of color and at least, you know, having no consultation about that. Now, I know there has been some, you know, kind of mixed opinions on the level of consultation because I have heard reports that Dr. Shirley, before he died, did say it was okay to make this.
And did talk with the main
but
screenwriter.
The family was
very much against it and very much disagreed.
So, like,
and I wonder, you know, it's easy to...
It's very difficult.
As it is with Bohemian Rhapsody, it's easy to gloss over or distort the perspective of a person when they're gone. You know, it's easy to reframe them into this kind of Hollywood crowd-pleaser context. And the thing about this film is it is extremely formulaic, not just in the depiction of Doc Shirley, but also Tony Lip, really caricatured in order to create the easy narrative. Mm. So you can definitely feel real life people and real life issues being distorted in order to create an easy crowd pleasing formula
but
film.
It kind of made me think about it, and especially this Oscars this year kind of made me think about this quite, you know, stringently about what do we expect from our mainstream cinema? Or do we expect that kind of reality? Or when we go into see a mainstream movie,
I will say,
do we like put that suspension of disbelief just there?
Green Book is very old school in a lot of ways. Yeah. It feels like what we expected of Hollywood entertainment 30 years ago. But I'll say this about Green Book. I think outside, it's uncomfortable in some ways, but in a lot of ways, it's not that bad. I think it's extremely well-oiled. As I said before, the characters are really broadly drawn to the extent that you can easily say they're caricature, but the positioning of the character beats and the editing
yeah.
is excellent. It's really old school Hollywood crowd pleaser. It ticks all the boxes with a certain level of charm, which I think you can bring that kind of charm back to the Farrelly Brothers films. It's the same kind of like warm, kind of dumb, but humane energy.
But also,
it's
very reflective of the Academy voters who actually form, you know, the Oscars committee and who get to watch these films on probably a screener or a laptop and not actually in the cinemas, you know.
Simple tastes.
Yeah. But also, like, we talk about that the Oscars are diversifying in its you know, membership and whatever. But
And Roma isn't
actually,
even all that challenging.
Yeah. Actually, are they, though? Are they diversifying? Yeah, probably are every year, but not
much. It suggests that they're not really diversifying for Green Book to go all the way, because it's such a film.
They don't understand what diversifying means when you can pick a movie about, you know, a black man and black issues that was not written by, you know, black people.
But not just that. The bigger crime isn't that it wasn't written by black people, is that it is telling us, it's telling the same story, which is like driving Miss Daisy from 20 years ago. It doesn't feel like, and it doesn't feel like a genuine depiction of racism. It's a very, you never feel like you could be the racist in this story. Yeah. It's designed to make you feel good about yourself. Mm. A much more interesting and nuanced take is in the film we'll be talking about next week, If Beale Street Could Talk, which shows you the multifaceted ways that racism plays a part in black people's lives and all the levels it's present in society.
But it's interesting, Green Book is a 2019 film precisely because of that. Because in today's world, I mean, if you are the racist, you now have the kind of...
No one wants to think they're racist. Exactly. So a movie like Green Book flatters the America that elected Trump.
Especially, not just that. I mean, all across the world, you know, white people now who are being called out for their racism can be, you know, chest beat and say, how dare you? How dare you call me a racist? Yep. You know, so it's almost trying to make you feel better about that.
Mm. So that was it for this week. Next week, we'll be talking again about If Beale Street Could Talk and also Vox Lux and maybe some other stuff. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening, and
maybe we'll actually fight next week too.
Yeah. There hasn't been too much of that on Film Fight Club.
We've been fighting racism this week.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Just like the
big issues.
Producers of Green Book. keep enjoying movies and hating the Oscars. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Bye.